very newsy time, so we are spoiled for very important news breaks and also complex stories, complex cluttered stories. So what we are doing today is we are talking about two of them. One is a bit more polarizing, sort of in terms of national politics. Second, socially polarizing in a way. So we'll talk about the first one in somewhat less detail and the second one a little bit more comprehensively. So first, as you might have guessed by now, is the Modi government's sort of sudden decision to not extinguish, they've been careful now to clarify it, not extinguish, it's a technical thing or symbolic thing, whether you extinguish it or you merge it with something else. So this is like that old song, Jot Se Jot Jagate Chalo. So they are taking the eternal flame in memory of Amar Jawan, the immortal soldier, from the India Gate position where it's been there for 50 years. This is the 50th anniversary of 1971 war. This was, the flame was installed there, the memorial was installed there by Mrs. Gandhi's government before 26 January 1972 to commemorate all Indian soldiers who had sacrificed their lives fighting for the country, whether known or unknown. This is now being taken away and being merged with the flame already burning at the National War Memorial, which is adjoining the India Gate area near the obelisk there. It's a beautiful memorial. There is a flame burning. So symbolically, a flame will be taken from this one there and it will be merged there. To understand this better, even when the National War Memorial flame was lit, again a torch was taken from Amar Jawan Jyoti and that flame was lit. And if you go to the website of National War Memorial, that also says that Amar Jawan Jyoti is part of our heritage. Now that heritage is being merged. You want to see more details of this? See the story done by Snehesh Alex Philip, our defense editor. In fact, I will share that story with you in the description. So please see that. Immediately, this has become controversial and there are protests from Congress party, especially Rahul Gandhi himself has spoken. And he's called it an insult to Indian soldiers. And he said that Modi government does not know how to respect or how to honor the memory of soldiers, brave soldiers who sacrificed their lives. And when they come back to power, if they come back to power, they will reinstall the Amar Jawan Jyoti where it used to be. Now, this has some very complex issues. Now, on the surface, it might just look like, oh, because Indira Gandhi had installed it, Modi government and BJP government, because they think now they are in power for a long time. They are in their second stint in power and they think they are front runner for the next also. So effectively, they see the odds that they will be serving at least as much time in power in Delhi with a majority as Indira Gandhi might have done, although her tenure was broken by the post-emergency defeat. So they think that they can also install their own landmarks and maybe replace some of those that they inherited from the past. That, however, is a more simplistic explanation. The complexity here lies, if you see that press release which has come out quoting sources, apparently Prime Minister's office sources, that press release also says that this current flame is installed at a monument which is a colonial monument. That is India Gate. Now, India Gate is where the Republic Day parade is held. India Gate, like Gateway of India in Bombay, have been seen to be symbols of India. Never mind that these were inherited from the British, because if you really stretch it, then is Taj Mahal a symbol of India? Is Red Fort a symbol of India? Then you begin to go too far and life begins to get too complicated. But history is complicated. Politics right now is not just what is happening today. It's not just economics and jobs, it's also ideology. And a lot of the ideology today in India is about history. So BJP government is also making an ideological point that this India Gate is a colonial monument. This is a symbol of our slavery to the British. Also the names of soldiers inscribed on India Gate, and similarly, a similar story with Gateway of India in Mumbai as well, that both these memorials were built for those Indian soldiers who had fought for the British Armed Forces in the World War. So this was in their honor. These are not in the honor of soldiers who fought for independent India. Their names are not inscribed here. So that is the philosophical and I would say principled point that Modi government has taken. Now this has many complications and this leads to many complications. Why? Because first of all, Indian Armed Forces have never seen independence as a break in their history. Indian Armed Forces see theirs as an unbroken history from when these regiments, these units were formed. That's why you would say, oh, Assam Rifles is the oldest paramilitary force in India. It is, right? The British had set it up. Or some of the more storied regiments of Indian Army, some went to the Pakistan Army after partition. They all still keep the trophies and the histories and honor the heroes and gallantry award winners in British times. For example, Field Marshal Sam Manekshaw had a military cross from the British times, which he earned during the fighting in what used to be Burma then. He was not embarrassed about it. Indian Army was not embarrassed about it. Indian Armed Forces, Army, Navy, Air Force are not embarrassed at all about the honors that they earned fighting for the British before India became independent. In fact, they see their regimental histories, their squadron histories, everything as a continuum. Indian Army, in fact, has the same name. It never had the prefix Royal with it. There was Royal Indian Air Force and Indian Navy, but Indian Army has been Indian Army. And they've carried a lot of, in fact, all of those traditions. And many of those regimental days are still celebrated or observed in the memory or in commemoration of battles and great actions of bravery and sacrifice that took place during the British times. So in the Indian Armed Forces worldview as yet, Indian soldiers fighting in the First and the Second World War were not fighting for a foreign power technically. They were fighting as professional soldiers. They were not a political army. They were not an ideological army. Similarly, even today, India's armed forces are not ideological. They are not political. They are not like the PLA of China, which is ideological, which is political, which is owned by a political party. In this case, the Communist Party of China, the Chinese Communist Party, CCP. In fact, we have explained this earlier in the CTC as well, that it's a strange country. Just as we say Pakistan, we have strange neighbors, in fact. In Pakistan, we say it's a country where in most other countries have armies. In Pakistan, the army has the country. In China, it's a completely unique case. There, the party has the country and the party also owns the army. So it is the Central Military Commission in the Chinese Communist Party that controls the Chinese Armed Forces, that is the PLA, Army, Navy, Air Force, etc., etc., etc. In India, that tradition is not there. Indian tradition has been a straightforward professional army. I am a professional soldier. I get a job. As a soldier, I volunteer and I go and fight, and I fight for my honor, for my regimental pride, for my country, for my flag, whatever. So this is now a big contradiction, because if Indian Armed Forces now have to say that our history begins with 1947, when the British went away, everything that happened under the British, in the service of the British. That is the counter argument that, look, when you guys were fighting for the British, then Indian soldiers were mercenary soldiers. They were fighting for money. Now that is a very fraught argument, because if Indian soldiers who fought before the partition were mercenary soldiers, then how would you describe today, for example, a lot of the Gurkhas from Nepal, not Indian Gurkhas, there's a lot of them now, a lot of the Gurkhas from Nepal who still enroll in the Indian Army and fight, would you call them mercenary? So this is now becoming a very complex debate, and that is where it's being pushed, and you can see that the ideological push is coming from that direction. Now what happens right now is, you see this contradiction within Delhi, within about a mile and a half, if at all, mile and a half as a crow flies, and under the Modi government, two actions. One, the removal or merger of this flame from under India Gate with the flame at National War Memorial, on the grounds that India Gate is a symbol of colonial slavery, and also it only honors those Indian soldiers who might have fought for the British. Now, government is not saying that, but I see many veterans also on social media elsewhere saying, oh, why is the flame resting, which is actually a memorial for mercenaries, Indian soldiers who fought as mercenaries. But just a mile away as the crow flies, or maybe just a little over a mile away, where Teen Murti Road begins, at that junction where the Teen Murti Memorial is, that Teen Murti Memorial has now been renamed Haifa Memorial by the same Modi government. Why Haifa Memorial? Because this is a memorial to three sort of super heroes of Indian cavalry who had fought in the battle to free Haifa. In whose army, for whose army were they fighting? Haifa may be today in Israel, but they were fighting for the British. So they were as much in the service of the British as the soldiers who fought in the First World War or the Second World War. They were professional soldiers. So the same government now actually says, just to call it Teen Murti, did not do adequate honor to Indian soldiers who fought in Haifa. Doesn't matter who they fought for. The same Modi government is saying that this Amar Jawan Jyoti, which actually honors the memory of Indian soldiers, can't sit under India Gate, which is a memorial to colonial slavery. So that is where these contradictions come in. And these contradictions will widen. For example, if you think the battles that Indian soldiers fought in the past were fought for the British, so they should be forgotten. First of all, every storied regiment, so many cavalry regiment, what used to be Hodson's Horse earlier, Skinner's Horse, many of them fought on the British side even in 1857. So they will have to wipe out their regimental history. Will they wipe out their regimental history? I don't think so. The awards and honors that people like Marshal of the Air Force Arjun Singh earned fighting for the British, will those now be written off? I don't think so. Similarly, if you apply this logic, then will you continue celebrating the Battle of Saragadi? The Battle of Saragadi was a very heroic chapter in the history of Indian Armed Forces, particularly the Sikh Regiment. Okay, it wasn't as fancy and as colorful as it's been made out to be in that movie. Even the uniforms were not so colorful. But the fact is, these were professional soldiers who died, who fought to the last bullet, last man. They didn't care which government were they fighting for. They were professional soldiers. That is the code of honor of the Indian Armed Forces. Will you then celebrate Saragadi, the Battle of Saragadi, as a great heroic chapter in the history of Indian soldiering or not? Then all the Indian leaders, including Indian chiefs, when they go to many parts of the country, particularly in Europe, they visit memorials, graveyards, cemeteries that have been built in the memory of tens of thousands of Indian soldiers who died in those battles. Will they stop doing it now, saying that, oh, these guys were fighting for a colonial power, so we should not be seen honoring them too much? Can you now retrospectively put a gap, put a break in history? Because once you say that, then you also internalize the idea, and you may not say it today, but in the course of time, other people will say, this is a history of Indians as mercenaries because they were fighting for the British. It's a very complicated thing. Now, at the same time, we see now a new statement that Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose's statue will be put there. Wonderful. Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose was one of the greatest Indian heroes of the 20th century. Is he undersung? Relatively, yes. Because for various reasons, after independence, India could have done a lot more in his memory or to celebrate him. But there's a little trickiness to this. Because in the Indian Armed Forces have not really celebrated Netaji Subhash Chandra Bose and INA, because in such conservative institutions, that was still seen as a mutiny. And that's been a sore point on many sides. So maybe to an extent, it's a good thing that wrong is being corrected. The fact that those soldiers fought against the crown at that point, I think we should be mature enough now to say that we no longer need to see that as, we no longer need to see that as mutiny. So that can be, but one in place of the other. How do you call India Gate a colonial monument, but Teen Murti a Haifa memorial, which India should celebrate just because Haifa now happens to be in Israel? Now those are things where we walk into more tricky territory. So I will leave you here with this. Now the second part of today's episode of Cut the Clutter is about the Supreme Court judgment by the two-judge bench of Justice D.Y. Chandrachud and A.S. Bopanna on OBC reservations in NEET, that is the National Eligibility and Entrance Test for Medical Admissions. Now we had told you earlier that in the Jan 7 order, they had allowed counseling to begin for this year for admissions both to undergraduate and postgraduate courses, saying that they will give their reasoning later in a reasoned proper judgment. That judgment has now come out, and one of the good things about some of the judges in the Supreme Court now, particularly Justice Chandrachud, I must say that, is that they give brief judgments. They don't write tens of thousands of words which confuse you with their syntax, grammar. They are not actually referring to the thesaurus and writing incomprehensible sentences, as you might have seen with that Himachal High Court judge who's been pulled up 4 times by the Supreme Court now for writing incomprehensible judgments. These judgments are very clearly written with great clarity and vision. Now, this judgment, basically, first of all, you all know the headline, that this says that 27% OBC quota is okay, that this is not contrary to any spirit or letter of the Constitution, and they've given their reasons. Also, this time, they've given very good reasoning for what is merit. What is merit and what is backwardness? It's very interesting. I will read out some passages for you. I will also tell you some highlights to begin with. Now, what they say is, point number one, Article 15.4 and 15.5 of the Constitution are not exceptions to Article 15.1. Now, Article 15, as we know, is the article that guarantees us equality irrespective of our place of birth, our caste, our religion, our gender, anything. So the argument that the other side might have had was that Article 4 and 5, that subclause 4 and 5 of Article 15, which gave government the power to provide reservations, etc., that is contrary to Article 15.1. So the most important part of the judgment is that they say Article 15.4 and 15.5 are not exceptions to Article 15.1d. In fact, they go on to say these two actually ensure that the spirit of substantive equality that 15.1 promises or guarantees the citizens of India is implemented totally. So they see 15.4 and 15.5 as empowering 15.1 and not running contrary to it. So they say that to find substantive equality under Article 15.1, you first have to recognize existing inequalities. So while 15.4 and 5 restate the principle of substantive equality, they also give you a method of doing that, and that is a group-based method, that is backward castes, backward classes, etc., etc., and so on. Then they go on to say the next important point, the second important point, is that merit cannot be reduced to narrow definition of performance in an open competitive examination, which of course provides equality of opportunity in that examination. Because they then talk about inequalities of the past. I will tell you that in a little bit more detail in a bit. Number three, higher scores in an exam cannot be a proxy for merit. Because when you see somebody's overall merit, you have to see it socially, in the social context, and also reconceptualize it in terms of the social context, the background, the upbringing, the economic, social, and other factors that go back into time. Point number four, that Article 15.4 and 15.5 actually help by identifying a method through group identification to bring about substantive equality. This is a very important judgment because this was the main challenge for a long time, that Article 15.4 and 15.5 are in contradiction with Article 15.1. These judges have said actually they are complementary to each other. And finally, that this All India quota, the principle of All India quota in medical seats, that is, states had their own seats. So Supreme Court, it was done by a Supreme Court order. Supreme Court said that, okay, every state will allocate a certain number of seats to an All India quota, which will be merit-based. Now, this was understood by, say, the upper caste side as meaning that because these were merit seats, states had given these away and states had reservations in their own seats, these seats will be without any reservations. So again, the Supreme Court said that was not the intention. These are merit seats only to the extent of the place of origin of the candidates. Let me explain it to you. Too many states said that all the seats in our medical colleges or almost all the seats are reserved for domiciles of our state. Now, once again, the principle of equality under Article 15.1 guarantees your equality irrespective of your place of birth. So it was that inequality that this All India quota, creation of an All India quota by the Supreme Court of India under directions of the Supreme Court of India was meant to resolve. That was the only inequality, that was the only issue of merit. Otherwise, just imagine, and this is notional, suppose a candidate from Uttarakhand or Punjab wanted to apply for a seat in Tamil Nadu, she won't be allowed to do so, she'll be disqualified just because she was not a domicile of Tamil Nadu. That's how a certain number of seats have taken out of each state and put in this national quota, which is a merit quota, but merit is only confined to the fact that these are open to everybody. So equal merit for you, irrespective of where you come from. This does not preclude the need for caste and social status-based reservations. That's what this judgment has said. Now, a few parts of the judgment which I find very interesting. For example, I just told you that the judges have said that merit should be socially contextualized and reconceptualized. That quote, merit should be socially contextualized and reconceptualized as an instrument to advance, quote again, social goods like equality, and not just be, and I quote again, and not just be reduced to narrow definition of performance in an open competitive exams. And then the judges go on to say higher scores in an exam is not a proxy for merit. And then they explain as to why. This is very important. They say competitive exams assess basic current competency to allocate educational resources, but are not reflective of excellence, capabilities, and potential of an individual, which are also shaped by lived experience. Very important. Aap jhuki jhopri mein rahe, were you brought up in a slum, or were you brought up in a rich gated colony? So competitive exams assess basic current competency to allocate educational resources, but are not reflective of excellence, capabilities, and potential of an individual, which are also shaped by lived experiences, subsequent training, and individual character. So it's not as if your own hard work and your own studies, etc., don't matter. But that's one of the three factors that cannot take precedence over everything else. And then the judges go on to say, these do not reflect the social, economic, and cultural advantage that accrues to certain classes and contributes to their success in such examination. So once again, a very substantive point made. Then they go on to say that, look, impact of backwardness doesn't disappear because of a graduate degree. Because one of the arguments of the challengers was that, look, you've given reservation for undergraduate courses. So once they are there, then there is equality. Why should you give reservation in postgraduate courses? So judges say in this judgment, very important judgment, that impact of backwardness does not disappear because of a graduate degree. So reservation must continue at postgraduate level as well. And this is certain economic and social mobility comes in because of a graduate degree, but it does not create parity between forward and backward caste and classes. That's very important. And then they go on to say that if you look at backward or poor castes or classes, then opportunities evade them because of structural barriers. So you need reservations now continuing to fight those or lower those structural barriers for them or compensate them for the structural barriers they may have faced. And they go on to say the only way merit can be, unquote, a democratic force that equalizes inherited disadvantages and privileges. Otherwise, claims of individual merit are nothing but tools of obscuring inheritances that underline these achievements. That's the reason this bunch of reasonings that you have in this judgment. It's a short judgment, 106 pages in large type with lots of space. Please read that. I will share an uncut version of the judgment with you. Remember, this will be quoted for a long time. And also let me mention a little factoid to you. Justice D.Y. Chandrachud, one of the two judges on this bench, he wrote this judgment. He did his PhD at Harvard, in fact, on the subject of affirmative action. So you find maybe a lot of the reasoning reflecting in this judgment as well. It's one of the more significant and wise judgments delivered by a Supreme Court. So in conclusion, let me just quote a couple of sentences. Quote, individual difference may be a result of privilege, fortune, or circumstances, but it cannot be used to negate the role of reservations in remedying the structural disadvantages that many groups in our society suffer. And then say that, look, open competitive exam, they give you equality of the exam, but they don't counter inequalities of the past. Reservation overcomes these barriers, and they say schooling, coaching centers, social networks, cultural capital, commercial capital, accent, how you speak, say English language or maybe Hindi or any other language, academic accomplishments, all of these can be inherited, right? Your accent can be inherited depending on which schools you went to and what is spoken at your home. Cultural capital, networks, social networks, all that can be inherited. And they say child is trained unconsciously by familial environment as well. All of these add up to merit as reflects in an exam, and that's why you need reservation to bring about some kind of fairness and some kind of an equalizer. So once again, please read this judgment, and thank you very much for watching.